Welcome. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight, it's another great show, dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and a significant application of some principles in science. Tonight, I thought we'd talk about knowledge and what it is, because most people seem to have an idea that they know what knowledge is. But I think after tonight's show, maybe we'll have a better understanding of it. And I also think that maybe for the first time for some people, they'll actually get the idea that knowledge is not the same as thought. Because a lot of people think, well, knowledge is like thinking, isn't it? Well, not exactly. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what is thought so that we know what that is. And for those of you who have listened for a while, you probably know the answer to that. But thought is a part of the universe and part of God's mind that constructed everything that we can imagine and everything that exists. So it's a kind of interesting thing because thought is the real creator. The creator, of course, is God, but it's God's own thought that began everything. And so from that perspective, there are two parts to thought. There's the first part of, I call God's mind, that has the application of principles of purpose and also will, choices, which are part of will. And because if you have a lot of choices consistently, then you have will. And other parts of the first part of thought in of God's mind include such things as creativity. Now, that's an important part, in my opinion. And freedom. Freedom, yeah. So all of that comes together with a bunch of other words I could use, but I think you're getting the general gist. And to make something that is a actual thought, it needs another component, and that is consciousness or direction to the thought. Now, these are all the same thing. Consciousness, direction, they're all part of the second part of God's mind. And some people will call it inclusiveness. Some people might refer to this second part as planning. There's a lot of words. They all fit into the second part of God's mind. And when you put the two together, you end up with thought. If you have a lot of choices, but there's no direction to the choices, and they don't affect the field that the choices exist within, that's another thing I didn't mention, but it's pretty important. The limitation of the field is sometimes referred to. If it doesn't do that, then you can't really call it a thought. You could call it like, well, it's kind of almost a thought, but it isn't a whole thought because it has no direction. And it doesn't have any effect on anything. Thinking is really something that causes new stuff to happen. New creations. Not just creation, but new things that are what we would call limiting the field of existence. And that's what God did. It chose to do that. And it chose to do it in a number of different ways. But the most important way, and the most important thing it did, was it decided that it wanted to grow, but in order to grow, since it was the only and super great thinker at the time or at the point when it created itself, which is an amazing idea, after that point, it said, well, you know, I could go on making up stuff, but that's no interest. There's no real, nothing new going to be happening. So it decided to create life and do something for life that is similar to what it had in itself, which was the freedom to choose its own ways of thinking and to limit its ways of thinking in its own direction of thought, which may not be in God's direction, by the way. And this unique idea, we'll call it, allowed there to be life that was free to create itself and co-create with its creator or to choose not to. And this is an amazing factor. It also limits God. God chose to limit itself, and therefore its own thought, from forcing life to think only as God thinks. Really great idea. Okay, so that giving us some idea of what thought is, and I could talk a lot more about thought, but that gives us a real, like a thumbnail sketch. Then where does the third part of God's mind come in? And that third part is the form that thought is contained within. There's a form, we call it. And the form has the ability to allow life to be, we'll call it, individual and separate from other life and separate from God too. So form is a way of separation of life that allows life to become individual, not become some kind of like glob of things, and because then all life would just be an average of life. But this is no averages now. As a matter of fact, the very principle of form is that it's characterizing the function of God's freedom. When form exists, it kind of ensures to some extent that individuality will result. It's a good thing. And again, our creator, God, decided that that was the way it wanted things to be. So it chose that everything that has thought in it has a life that is also considered a life form would in some way have some element of energy in it. Now, there are some unique kinds of life forms, very few kinds, but there are some, that don't ever choose to use energy in their form. And therefore, they are, in technical standards, formless. But they exist as beings outside of the realm of God's, we'll say, plan for life within the universe, because they come from outside of the universe. It's a little hard to understand it. And they're called monads. It's a little hard to understand that whole idea. But with the exception of that, I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail about that tonight. Generally, life is in form, and it uses energy to produce the form and energy to allow itself to interact with other life forms. And that's what the third part of God's mind is about. It's about life having forms that can interact with each other. And when the interaction is along God's thought, we call it intelligent interaction. Generally, it doesn't have to be perfectly along God's thought. So it's a sort of, we'll call it, in the direction of. And at various dimensional levels, it may be less than by far how God's actual thought is, but it's in that genre. Then there are life forms that sometimes choose to not go in God's direction. Well, that's part of the freedom, right? And they have less than intelligent interactions. In some cases, they have virtually no intelligence to their interactions. Now, what is intelligence? Intelligence uses less and less energy to communicate and to cooperate, to interact. And that's the good news, because the less energy that is used, the more time is conserved, and it stays part of and joins with space, and the less energy in general is being brought into a system, which usually leads to high levels of force. Forces are one kind of energy against another. So if you have a lot of different energies coming from a lot of different life forms who aren't really all thinking together because they aren't intelligent in their activity, you end up with a lot of forces. And forces are the unfun part of life. But there are some parts of life that love force, that parts that don't want to be part of God. And we sometimes refer to the extreme of that as evil. All right, so the interesting thing about everything I've explained so far is we have yet to get to knowledge. But in a weird way, we're using knowledge, but we haven't got to what it is. But we're going to get there. Now, and why am I starting with this? Because knowledge explained is only going to make sense if you have a foundation of what knowledge actually is. And knowledge is on the third part of God's mind's spectrum. It has to do with the form. The form of thought changes. Sometimes the form of thought is not specifically knowledge. Oh, you don't find that hard to believe. Well, it's true. Sometimes the form of thought is above and beyond what is construed and defined as knowledge. But knowledge is a big factor, especially where human beings are concerned. But we'll see that a lot of parts of life use knowledge. So knowledge is thought within form, and the form of a thought is what we call knowledge. So knowledge is a form of thought, and therefore contains energy, because it's part of a form. And when we discuss knowledge, therefore, it is a thing rather than the thought that is in the thing. And that's what confuses everybody. I have not known somebody, including myself, at least at some point in my spiritual and we'll call it metaphysical development, where there was a complete understanding of this concept. It is hard to get that knowledge is not thought. Knowledge is the form of thought that is used in some dimensions of time and space. Whoa! Talk about confusing everything. And we'll talk about what the differences of some of the other forms of thought are about and how you get there, so to speak, tonight. So by the end of tonight's show, a lot of this will be all explained. I realize right now I'm probably confusing some people, but that's okay. I mean, this is kind of like the challenge, okay? I say what it is, and then people go, huh? And I hope by the middle to the end of the show, people will be saying, I think I'm getting it. This guy is not completely crazy. He's explaining it. He can explain it. Okay. So since knowledge is a form of thought, there are also different parts to the form of knowledge. How do you like that? Most of the knowledge that humans have is focused or contained within the form of higher and lower mental energies. But not all, by any stretch, because humans use another kind of knowledge in the astral world. Sometimes as much as they use mental, and that form of thought is called creative imagination. Yeah. That's when you picture things, and you can convey the pictures to other people, which means that, obviously, it's a way of interacting with people. And you can also create actual forms of the, we'll call it imagination, out of astral energy. Interestingly, most people don't know this, but you can do the same in the mental world. You can create forms of knowledge in the mental world, and the forms can be either in lower mental energy, which is, and then they're called thought forms, and not to be confusing, but then there are higher mental forms that are called conceptual forms, concept forms. And so you have thought forms and you have concept forms, but they're both forms of thought, so it's really confusing. Now, why am I using that? Because that's a convention that has been used since the mid to late 19th century. And so the problem is that instead of somebody understanding everything I'm teaching about tonight, they understood enough to get themselves in hot water and make words up that really don't explain what we're talking about. But hey, we got to live with what we got to live with, and that's the convention of where it says they are chosen to be today. Okay, so there's concepts and there's thought forms. The concepts are like the formula. Think of it as a formula of what the thought form is, which is an example of the formula. So, and we talk about formula, and it could be mathematical. As a matter of fact, technically, all concepts have some mathematical component to them. That's a little hard to understand because there's a lot of concepts that don't seem to have much to do with math, but they actually do have some mathematical component to them when you go into the depths of what they are about. And all, supposedly, thought forms are examples of some concept. How do you like that? And as an example, they're very useful because then people can say, well, I know what that means because they can see the example. But they may have trouble with the concept because concepts include vast numbers of examples. And the more examples that a concept has before there's a contradiction, then the more true we call the concept. If it has no contradictions presently in human understanding, then we usually say, well, that's the truth. But you know what? The truth kind of changes because sometimes we discover new examples of something that we thought for sure was the truth, and sure enough, they don't hold up and don't support the concept. They cause a contradiction, and then we say, well, there you go. It's not the truth anymore. Truth is kind of like that. It moves around. And it is not, from time to time, the same. It tends to, as concepts become larger, or more well understood, really, but they're larger, to humans, they then find examples that now no longer fit what was the original concept. And many times that causes a change in the truth. Other things that cause a change in the truth is a misunderstanding of examples in relationship to concepts in the first place. And that could cause, you know, it always says, well, we always thought that was right, but it never was. We just didn't realize. Oh, there you go. So that's another part of it. Okay, so it's a fascinating idea here is that the form of knowledge changes based upon what dimension and what kind of brain you're using, by the way. The hope is the brain stores knowledge, stores it in terms of the way knowledge is created on in the dimension that the brain exists in. The astral brain cannot reasonably understand mental knowledge. It understands astral knowledge, which is pictures, imagination of things. But it doesn't very well understand concepts and particularly thought forms and particularly concepts. So it needs help and a link up with the mental brain so that it can more fully understand what a person experiences. Human beings experience all three of the lower dimensions of time and space in their knowledge base. So their form of knowledge is joined together with from the mental plane, the astral, and believe it or not, the physical. Now, I haven't talked about that much, but let's talk about it for a second. In the physical world, knowledge is really about coordinating yourself with all the forces of the physical world and being able to intelligently communicate how to reduce forces for yourself and others. On a moment-to-moment basis, it's almost always based upon what has already occurred. And the interesting thing about this is that actually is what is called etheric and, to a lesser extent, physical knowledge. That's what it is. The ability to do that is actually embedded within and part of most of what we call the etheric and physical brain. About 95% of the etheric physical brain concerns itself with that kind of thought. There's a little part of 5% or so, in some people, maybe 6 or 7%, of the of the physical brain that connects to, in most people, the astral and the maniacic brains, so that there is a direct connection, so that the physical brain does have some corresponding awareness of how astral knowledge and mental, both higher and lower knowledge, have to do with how we intelligently coordinate ourselves in the physical world. Some people that are more prone to thinking a lot connect a lot of things with the three brains. We call them very intelligent people. Some people don't, and we call them not too intelligent. Isn't that interesting? Whereas in the outside of the aspects of what I just said, they may be equal in their intelligence in terms of coordinating their responses with the forces in the world around them and the energies in the world around them. They can be just as equal in those ways, but that by not being able to join as well with the astral and the mental brains, they actually diminish in their overall, we'll call it human-like intelligence. And that's very important to think of, because let me explain how that works. Human beings connect everything I just said, but animals don't. For the most part, other than a few pets we have, and most animals do not connect mental thought and the form of thought, which would be knowledge, with their astral brains or their physical. That the brains are the storage devices now, so they get they can't store much mental knowledge. And that allows them to, unfortunately, not have the same kind of life that human beings have. So they live very differently. Most of the mental knowledge they get comes from their group soul rather than their own experiences, and it's a lot of preconceived thought of the group soul. We call it instincts. And so they act together as a group. That means they don't have much mental individual nature to them, especially wild animals. And plants, let's go down a little lower. Plants now are more prone to etheric knowledge, but very limited astral and almost zero mental, because they just don't have any, we'll call it thought, form of thought in those realms, and they don't have any brains that we would call brains to think through. So it's a real strange thing that they are missing that. They do have some coordinated intelligent response, but they generally work together somewhat as a group and more with the help of energies from the energy kingdom that help them out. So it's really a weird kind of thing that they do. Animals do a little bit of that too, but not as much as plants. Fascinating. So our brains really play a big role, and with animals it's much less so, and plants you could virtually say is non-existent in that realm. And so it's a whole thing, and that means that plants don't really have much memory, because the storage principle is what gives us memory, and the brain is a storage device. It's storing knowledge. Okay, so let's get on to the rest of the story then. So if we have, now as I've explained it, a profound amount of knowledge that we experience in our lives, and it happens in three different dimensions of time and space, and it's being stored in three different kinds of vessels we call brains, and in those, each one of those storage places, the energy that's stored is very different. But there is a small amount of each brain that is used to connect the brains. The better they connect, the more intelligent we call ourselves, because we're able to respond better to circumstances. That is, and better in the sense of it being more intelligent or more like God. That's a really good thing. I'm going to get into how we can improve all this later in the show, but for right now, at least we know what we're talking about here. All right, now let's go a little bit higher. Let's talk about knowledge. Human knowledge pretty much stops at the top of the mental world. There is a small amount that humans can develop of knowledge in the intuitional or buddhic dimension, and that's on the lower three subplanes of the dimension of intuition. The form of thought in the buddhic world is intuition, and the kind of, we'll call it, structure that the intuition uses is called heurism or heuristics. Now, what does that mean? That sounds like something way out there. Well, a long time ago, a guy wrote a book. His name was Lonigan, Bernard. He was a priest, and he wrote a book that dealt with heuristic structures. I'm not sure how much he understood about the buddhic world, but the stuff he said about it was very accurate. And so the idea here is that instead of people thinking in concepts like humans do in the higher mental world, the parts of the buddhic world that are that humans can have some thought on is instead of thinking in a concept or several concepts, you think in all the concepts. All the concepts that are available in that world, we're on Earth, so this would be on Earth, about the general area of heurism or structure of knowledge that exists on one of the three different subplanes. And the area of the seventh subplane of the intuitional world deals with the area of all concepts that have anything to do with the physical part of existence, the theoretical physical part of existence, all of them. So now you don't think in terms of one concept, but you think in terms of all of them, and you take all of them and then pick out those that apply at the time in the most effective way to lead to the highest level of intelligence and the most like God. Different than how humans think in the mental world. So, okay, and then if you go to the sixth subplane of the buddhic world or intuitional world, it's all the knowledge, which is in concepts, but the concepts are joined together collectively, all concepts that presently exist on Earth about the astral world. The astral plane. And finally, you go to the fifth subplane of the intuitional world, and it's all knowledge that exists in terms of concepts about the mental world. So you have these three different brands of concepts that applies to all knowledge about three parts of the universe, dimensionally speaking. And that those areas is all the knowledge that is available on planet Earth at that moment in time and space from all beings, all concepts that actually support each other and without contradiction. Any concept that is within contradiction is immediately excluded from this structure that's called heurism. So heurism goes beyond truth because truth changes from time to time, but heurism is, for that second, always the greatest truth you can find about that dimension of time and space. And out of this fantastic array of, we'll say, whole concepts, because they really are whole, it's a whole, everything that's understood conceptually about that plane and about whatever you're thinking about within that plane, I might say, when you take it to that level, you have the mental concepts actually precipitating out of the concepts which were actually gigantic and that are like a huge big concept in a sense in the intuitional world. And the thing that's so amazing about this is it's thousands of times faster in terms of the ability to think. It's still knowledge, but you're using all knowledge, or omniscience, that's another word for all knowledge, in conceptual form, but it is now something different than a mental concept. It will call it a kind of lower intuitional plane concept, which is really like everything. And so you ultimately are reaching into a bridge over between the human kingdom, which usually can only think to the highest level at the mental plane, and into the kingdom of souls, which, when they're liberated, even beforehand, to some extent this is true, they think in terms of using all the concepts shared among them and between them, and that allows them to gain a much better understanding more rapidly of whatever it is they're thinking about and to communicate it virtually instantly between themselves. Therefore, intelligence goes way up when you can do that. And so activity becomes much, much more intelligent as you leave the human kingdom. You're either a human almost ready to go into the kingdom of souls or you're already there, and you have tremendous more accuracy in the conveyance of intelligence about any interaction with anyone else at or above that level. That's a fantastic thing to have, and that's what distinguishes those, what we call masters, or whatever, members of the next kingdom, then in relationship to human beings, for the most part. Now, a few human beings can do a little bit of this, but and at the very end of being a human, those humans can do a lot more than a little, but they are not quite there because you've got to do a more than what I just said. When you get beyond the fifth Buddhic subplane, or intuitional if you prefer that name, and say you get to the fourth, well, now you're outside of the realm of all concepts. And you say, well, what goes beyond concept? Well, this heroism I was talking about changes the form of thought from knowledge to what is called the precipitation of creation. So instead of trying to become aware of knowledge, which is mostly concerned with the past and present, it's dominated by that. It's only the mental plane that balances it to some extent to past, present, and future. But the balance of them still does not lead to the highest level of creativity. When you get to the fourth Buddhic plane, you become balanced with the universe and God and things beyond the planet that you exist on. And you start creating things that are extraplanetary and things that are beyond what has ever been in existence. And you start balancing the present level of, we'll call it knowledge, on a planet with the new creations that you and others are going to be doing to see what is going to do the most good, the most God, in the future, which makes it far more intelligent in terms of future time than just having the lower three sub-planes of the Buddhic plane at hand. Those lower are called the rain cloud of knowable things, and those are the things that people who are mostly human know or could know on the planet they exist on. When you get beyond that, now you're not dealing just with the planet. You're dealing with the universe, which is a lot, lot bigger than the planet, and because it involves billions, billions and billions of planets, and it has to do more with co-creation with God. You're not so concerned about creating more of goodness just in the race of humans on a planet. You're concerned about creating more of God throughout the universe. It does still affect the planet you're on, but it is a bigger picture to the whole thing. And you start thinking about other worlds and other stars and what other places are like and how you can help. A lot of other stuff comes into play. So it's a fascinating kind of thought process, isn't it? And that's called an unbridled heroism, where you're not connected to or you're not forced to think, so to speak, only in that which is knowable by humanity at the present time, but rather by what can be known maybe someday by humanity, and will and is known by beings on the planet or beyond the planet Earth. Fascinating ideas. Fascinating. Okay, so and since we create ourselves out of what we think, those that think in this kind of super omniscience, we'll call it, that goes beyond the fifth intuitional plane, or subplane, I should say, are creating themselves way beyond human beings. They're creating themselves into superhumans with amazing abilities and amazing interactions with beings that we have little or no knowledge about, in places and in ways that we have no knowledge of as humans. Again, we can really see the separation of how humans create themselves and why and how masters become something very different from humans. It's not like they sprinkle fairy dust on themselves. It's because they are thinking with a form of knowledge, omniscience, that is beyond human and beyond even the world that they are still somewhat connected to. Interesting ideas. Wow. All right. So if we want to define heroism, the best way to define it is it's the structure of the concepts and eventually going beyond concepts, the structure of, we'll call it super concepts. I don't know if there's no word for these things. That it is the understanding the person gets, not the concept itself any longer. That's the whole idea. And it defeats logic. Logic, when people try to use logic to understand heroism, most of the stuff they think of that seems logical is heuristically untruthful. It isn't supported by what's really happening. But because they can't think of enough concepts to see the bigger picture, we'll say, because they can't see the structure of those bigger concepts and where the whole thing is really held up by, their logic tells them it isn't right when it is, but they can't figure it out. Little you can do about that, because that's how humans are, and that's where they think from, so you kind of like stuck to try to prove something to somebody that they aren't willing to hear. And humans, generally speaking, don't like to think beyond a few concepts at a time because they get lost. So these giant things I'm talking about, pretty much most humans don't think that way. But nonetheless, they could get to the rain cloud of noble things if they were an advanced kind of spiritually disciplined person, and especially if they're mentally spiritually disciplining themselves very well, and they might be able to experience it. Now, it's called the rain cloud of noble things. That's because everything precipitates in human terms from that rain cloud. Okay, so we have, I hope, a better already understanding of knowledge, because here's all these different ways that knowledge represents itself. Each one is a different form of knowledge, a different form. And when you take all the forms and you look at them, humans generally have forms up to, but usually not much beyond, a few concepts as they can think of at a time. And the idea of omniscience to most humans is pretty much foreign. They don't do it, so they don't know that it exists in a form that others that are advanced humans, or in many cases, obviously superhumans, are doing. Okay, and so the more advanced the knowledge is, the more the intelligence is in the activity, and the more appropriate the knowledge is in relationship to the subplane, or to the plane, I'm sorry, where it is being used, the greater the intelligence also in terms of creating more of God. Wow. So we can see how this whole thing, I think, fits together, giving us an idea of what knowledge is. Okay, so we're going to come back in about 2.5 minutes and go a lot deeper and explain more of this. And I know some people are saying, well, this is Bob Wright again, pretty far out there. But I'm going to bring it down to an easier level now, so don't get too upset about it. And we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about knowledge and what it is and how we can improve upon it and how we use it and sometimes how we don't use it. So there you go. And hopefully the first part of the show, which was difficult. Why is it so difficult? Well, since we're talking about knowledge, let's talk about the knowledge that I conveyed in the first 40 minutes of the show. Most of that knowledge was based upon mental concepts. Now, mental concepts are great ways for us to, we'll say, find greater truth and to, in many ways, become more like our souls. That's a good thing. Nothing wrong with that at all. It doesn't necessarily, in and of itself, help us to necessarily coordinate ourselves in the physical world with people in etheric and physical ways. It gives us reasons why we might want to, but it doesn't actually help us to do it necessarily. And the interesting thing also is that it doesn't give us a very good, we'll say, imagination. It's not part of that system. But tonight's show, I'm not trying to use our imagination so much, at least I haven't so far. I'm trying to get into the parts of where people, and I generally say this, not necessarily everyone who's listening, have difficulty in gaining a reasonable explanation of the difference between how they think and what they think and what they know. And that's a very interesting thing. Some people know a lot of things. They have a lot of knowledge. And they have knowledge in many different ways. Some people are great in their creative imagination in that form of knowledge. Some people are fantastic in thought forms. They have a lot of examples of concepts that they can spit out. Those people might be really good at something called Jeopardy. But other people have, you know, knowledge that is more conceptual. And if you have a lot of strong conceptual knowledge that gets to higher parts of the higher mental world, then you get closer to your soul. So tonight's show, I'm trying to get people to exercise some of that part of themselves so that they will be, get closer to their soul, meaning that that part of them will then have a more meaningful derivative because it's closer to God. And it will allow them, therefore, to understand God better. You see, one of the things that is a problem here on Earth is that a good proportion, not necessarily even the majority of all people, but this could be close to that, do not have a very strong conceptual understanding of God. And why is that? I mean, the majority of people, by far, are faith-based, religious-wise, believers in God. That's an absolute fact. I mean, if you go and you took a poll, you'd find that to be true. But despite that, their understanding of God is relatively limited. Now, there's reasons for this. Most religions have kind of taken the track away from knowledge, especially conceptual knowledge, in terms of understanding God. And you could say, well, why would they do that? Because isn't knowledge one of the, it's a form of thought, and it's the form of thought that humans are absorbed in more than any other kind of life form other than those that are greater than human. So why shouldn't humans be using this to understand God? And the answer is rather strange, but it's based upon a lot of, as I have come to conclusions about it, a lot of information about the past. And that is that human beings have cross purposes. They don't necessarily, even if they are very deeply living their life around and about God, some of those humans that are doing that don't necessarily want to understand God. They want to either obey God, have God love them, maybe they want to love God, maybe they want God to help them in some way. They want to see others godly because they think it's better for them and everyone else to believe in God. So they have, we'll call it, a lot of agendas. And some, unfortunately, are not necessarily more godly in their approach about God. They see God as a means of having control and power and authority over others. And especially people in, we'll say, high political places in the past, especially like kings and sort of thing, they would align themselves with God to increase their authority and power over others. But it only works, only worked, provided that the others didn't have better understandings of God. So they decided, these people, especially this is true in Christianity, but it's also true if you look in the other religions that are common today, they chose to make their religions more faith-based rather than conceptual or knowledge-based. As a matter of fact, the people that said they were knowledge-based and trying to understand God, they were called Gnostics, were thrown out, literally. Their thought and their knowledge was thrown out of the Christian churches, different sects, some at different times, but pretty much around the in the 4th century. And when that took place, it left a big gap in that particular religion. And then it affected the religion. religion of Islam, because that religion came out of, to some extent, a Christian background. And it already took note of and was adopting the idea of restricting the Gnostics or the knowledge people, people seeking knowledge to, about God. And so that kind of went by the wayside. Now, of course, when you listen to this program, I'm trying to compensate for that missing element. So I'm on the other side. I'm trying to say, let's bring some understanding about God, we in here, and let others deal with the faith-based issues, because that's not my forte, and I need to balance what has been just about 100% faith-based way of defining God. And that, this is also true for Jews. It's true for people who are Hindus. It's true for people who are into virtually and Buddhist. But it's true for people of virtually every kind of religion. Now, Buddhists, some Buddhists, depending upon which one you're talking about, have some greater understanding of God, but not, as an example, Zen. Not Zen. Zen Buddhists actually may, in some respects, not really believe in a God. So it depends on who, what sect of a particular religion you're looking at. The critical element here is that the whole idea of God is the biggest of all concepts that we could possibly have. And the biggest of all understanding, which is consciousness, we could have, would be about God. So the growth of consciousness comes greatest to those who try to understand God, in my opinion. And so I think that that's what we're trying to do tonight, is to use this understanding of knowledge so we can gain a better understanding of God and see how God is working in various ways through the form of thought, part of which is knowledge, to help people to gain an understanding of God and themselves together. Not just of God, but of themselves. Because we're here to co-create with God, not to just be subjects of or worshipers of. That's my opinion now. And it's the opinion that is profoundly, we'll say, a doctrine generally within the we'll call it the general body of knowledge called Ageless Wisdom. Now, ageless wisdom in and of itself is knowledge based all the way past where I stopped, which was the rain cloud of knowable things, and into what is called pure heuristic structure, which would be above that through the entire Buddhic plane. It goes beyond omniscience. You might say, well, what's beyond omniscience? Well, then you're no longer dealing with just knowledge. Then you deal with knowledge and its completion in creative application. At the top of the Buddhic plane, you become the super creative being, but only in terms of thought. But when you get to the Atmic plane, you take the creative thought and you apply it. You become a creator of worlds and things within worlds, a super creator. And then you are called omnipotent, rather than just omniscient. Wow. But that's a whole other thing. So you could say at that point, knowledge just kind of morphed into this creation, and then in the creation became something that is applied creation, which we call omnipotence. So it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and closer to God, because God is omnipotent. Even if it chooses not to exercise its omnipotence so that others can choose to do so without its interference, that's what it does. But it still could. It just chooses not to. Amazing. Amazing. All right. So, all that highfalutin stuff aside, how does knowledge help us if we're going to, you know, since we have some understanding, it's about a form of thought. Why is it important to have more and better knowledge? Better being, in my explanation anyway, more intelligent, more like God. Good. Rather than evil and forceful, it's good. And it is reducing in forces, a reduction in forces. Then why do we want that? I mean, what is there to gain? The first thing that is gained is the thing called meaning. Okay, meaning. When knowledge is gained, and then when it is in some way acted upon through interactions with others, meaning in life grows. Okay, so what we think of as meaning cannot come just from having knowledge. I know some people may think differently about this, but that's okay. I'm open to that debate if they want to have it. But I'm saying that just having knowledge, even though it's perfectly exactly correct, is not meaningful unless it's in some way used in interaction with others that is helping the others to become more intelligent with us. Okay? Then the meaning in life increases. Therefore, we better define what meaning is, because if we don't, then what I'm saying won't make any sense, right? Meaning in life is the part of life that causes us to want to become more alive. To become more alive, and by necessity requires us to also become more like God in order to develop the meaning that is, we'll quote, non-destructive to either ourselves or to itself. So meaning that might exist for a short period of time could exist in ways outside as I'm defining, but meaning that lasts, in a sense, immortally, because it's connected to consciousness, which also is immortal, that meaning can only come from what I'm describing now as the ability to take the knowledge that we have and apply it in interactive ways with others so that they become more intelligent in their interactions while we are doing the same, and it's going out to everybody else, paying it forward, so to speak. And that is what meaning is. Meaning provides us with more life. We feel and we think more alive. We exist in a way that is of greater life. Oh, that's kind of an interesting idea. All right. Therefore, if you lose meaning in life, you're losing your life. Their life is becoming shrinking, smaller, smaller, smaller. And if you gain meaning in life by being destructive to the meaning of other people's lives, your life eventually will suddenly collapse to a very meaningless life. You might have a short term where you think it's growing because you're substituting power and control over others and sucking meaning from them, but eventually there is nothing left when you're done. So you can't hold on to meaning if it isn't in some way given to others and helps them to do the same. So it becomes a losing proposition. But for a short, relatively short time, it's possible to delude ourselves and to experience some kind of like, oh, Jesus is great, great fun destroying others. But it eventually leads to a profound loss of meaning, and it usually comes fairly quickly at a certain point, usually when the forces are so great that the forms of the knowledge and the forms of our bodies and our senses, everything just falls apart. All right, back to the point. Meaning is the critical element that people live for. Without meaning in life, most people do not seek life. Most people do not. They will try to hold on to a minimal level of life out of desperation and fear of death, but they don't, they may do that, but they don't seek more life that is meaningless. Interesting. So people that tend to not create meaning in their life because they don't take the knowledge that they have and apply it in any intelligent way, those folks are destined towards a relatively high level of suffering due to a loss of meaning in life. Okay, what about folks that don't have a lot of knowledge? Well, the good news is that if you don't have a lot of knowledge, you can actually get meaning from relatively simple interactions for a while. And as long as your knowledge level is equal to your interaction level, in theory, you could balance that out, and you could have a relatively meaningful life, but much less meaningful than you could otherwise have, or than others that you know or may could know would be having. It's a fascinating idea. So, based upon what I'm explaining, we can see now that, wow, just having knowledge alone doesn't lead to a meaningful life. It may lead to a rather depressing, non-meaningful life. You've got to apply the knowledge in ways that helps others to become intelligently interactive with you and with still others. So it's got to grow the whole system, or it just doesn't work. Wow. Who came up with that, by the way? Why is it so important that this is part of the system? It has to do with what motivates people to live. And God created the system so that it will work that way. Now, you could say, well, I don't understand that. Is it some kind of magical formula or something that we're not going to ever learn about? No, that's not it at all. It's that creation is part of it, and creation has to eventually become interactive. Just creating in your head without actually doing anything with the creation does not lead, in the long run, to a meaningful life. And that has to do with God again. It has to do with the expression of freedom and other things. You're not helping other people to be creative or free. You're not helping other people to interact. So the whole system is becoming a forceful, negative system. Even though you might think, well, I'm not really doing anything wrong, am I? And you are. You just don't recognize it. Except tonight, I'm explaining it. Okay, what about folks who spend their life studying? And they go to libraries and classes. And they get tapes and, you know, videos and just saturate themselves with what they call knowledge. Well, those folks, if that's all they did, and sometimes there are people that do that, eventually end up being living a meaningless life. And they become despondent, sometimes depressed, and don't know why. Sometimes they call me. I still. Or when I was a shrink, they would come in to see me for psychotherapy. But the thing is that the point is that there's a misunderstanding. Sometimes it happens while people are children. And it's conveyed by the system, including their parents, usually the parents at the beginning of it, that in some way you don't have to take creative responsibility for the knowledge you have. And you don't need to do anything that will improve intelligent interactions with other people. And you sort of live as a little solipsist kind of person without connections with other people, thinking that you live in your own kind of universe. And, I mean, you could say, people have a choice. They can do that. That's fine. And it's just, I think, you know, no one's going to come and say, oh, you're a bad person. But the end of that kind of existence, and if you're one of these folks tonight, I'm hoping that this will be of some help to you, is this awful meaninglessness that is of a great challenge for people to live their life with that. So that's where the problem comes in. Tonight, I hope to alleviate some of their problems and get people more onto the path of the soul. Souls don't have this problem at all, but humans do, and there's got to be a reason for that. I mean, the soul is, I mean, we all start as our soul, but we get segregated from the soul because our senses are diminished tremendously by the forces of the three worlds we live in where the soul doesn't, the lower mental, the astral, and the etheric physical. So what's going on? Well, you know, just because we're suddenly an incarnate human, we've lost everything that the soul has. Let me explain. The soul has a sense of unity in its senses that allows it to recognize the need to apply knowledge to gain intelligence in its interaction. So it is its nature to do that. Humans have the reverse. Humans take on a tremendous challenge. And that challenge is that their senses are going to get separated as soon as they're incarnated, even before they're born. And so the challenge is so great that they perceive a world of separation instead of a world of God. And they have, but they constantly, they have a sense of God, so they constantly are seeking God, but they have this counter productive experience of separation of everything, and therefore there is no God. And so the arguments and fight go on internally, producing what to do with the knowledge that is acquired as a person lives. And we have knowledge in all the different levels I described, and the knowledge is a form of thought that needs to not only be expressed to others, but help others to intelligently interact better with still others, not just with ourselves, and to co-create together, if possible, with as many people who can and will. So all this is done if you basically have an idea of how it's working. But unfortunately, some people just don't. And, you know, they don't necessarily listen to the show either, or reading stuff I've written or books or... So what is happening is you have world of people that get off track. Their senses, in illusion, give them wrong information, and they lose the meaning in their own existence by gaining knowledge without doing what they're supposed to do, which is co-create with it, and so then the results are pretty devastating. Now, I know there's going to be some people who are going to say, well, I got a solution. I'll lock myself in a closet and I won't gain any knowledge. Then I'm safe. You know, wear earmuffs all the time. I can't hear anything. I won't watch anything. I won't read anything. And there are some people that actually do that. They limit their exposure to knowledge because, in effect, they actually fear the lack of meaning in their life, and they think in some way that's going to be of some help to them. Of course, there is a problem, and the problem is ability. If we're able to have the knowledge, and we still choose to not have it, we still have a sense of loss, even though we may not understand the knowledge, we still have an awareness that the knowledge exists that we are choosing to ignore. And it leads to a similar condition of meaninglessness for those folks who choose that crazy path to go down. But there's a lot of people who do, so I wouldn't think it sound like there's just a few. There's a lot of people who do that. All right, so that's no solution, because you end up being pretty much back in the same problem. Except maybe worse, because then you're less able to get out of it because you have limited your ability to have knowledge. and you still might still have as much meaninglessness. All right, so the knowledge we have is an important asset, but knowledge just as knowledge that isn't creatively used is a liability. Same knowledge. It's how you choose, or I should say, what you choose to do with that knowledge that is causing these different results. And when I tell people that we're here to actually be active and to do things, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, some people say, well, does that mean I should get out and run or something? Or something? Maybe make plans to be busy every day or something? No, it has to do with creation and co-creation with others and helping them to intelligently coordinate themselves with us and intelligently create imaginatively with us and intelligently create mentally with us in terms of forms of thought and in concepts. I mean, the whole thing goes together, and it's pretty amazing. Now, how does knowledge become the creator in terms of higher spiritually developed folks? Well, in those who are not so developed, it generally works its way from the bottom up. So you first deal with your intelligently coordinated responses to the physical world around you, and as you do that better, with more intelligent coordinated responses with other people, less forces, you tend to become more creative astrally, using your creative imagination in various ways. And then eventually people tend to move into gaining a lot of examples of concepts, a lot of knowledge about that. And then they'll get knowledge about the concepts themselves and the conceptual framework. That's people who don't generally, who aren't generally very conscious, and they may not be that well developed in terms of each incarnation. They haven't maybe been here so much, or they haven't gotten that much out of the lives they have been here for. There's a better way to go about it, and the better way is from the top down. But from the top down, it really requires a lot more use of the knowledge sooner, and a lot more thinking at very high and difficult levels earlier than most people care to do, as a general rule. If you're into that, that's a good thing, provided, again, you apply it and use it to serve others, and you intelligently interact with others in a better and better way every day, every hour that you can. You make some improvements. That's a wonderful way to go about it, a harder way for a lot of people. Not everybody finds it harder, but then for a lot of people, they do. That's the way that's recommended if you're going to be living a spiritual life and you're dedicated to doing it. That's the way that grows your relationship with the soul. You may want to listen to the show from a number of weeks ago where I talked about that. And so that's the primary way that you want to do it if you're really trying to not only build the most meaningful life, but the life that is closest to your creator, and therefore to all others as souls. You actually deal with people then, seeing them as souls, than really as people in the more mundane sense. They recognize they have personalities that have all kinds of screwball things in them, but you see that really as a separate issue. They still are souls, unless they're evil, of course. And you're there to be co-creative with them. That's a good place to be. That's a great place to be. All right. So if we're trying to use this system in a way which, we'll say, is most productive, the harder way is the way that builds the most meaning in life. You're going to also have the greatest numbers of failures. I know that sounds crazy. Well, who wants to fail, right? The reason you're going to have more failures is because it's the most creative way. And you have to learn the highest levels of knowledge first, which is a very difficult thing to do. It's called more deductive in its process than inductive. It's a very difficult kind of way to grow yourself, but it produces the best results. Why you get better results by making more mistakes if you're being creative? Well, as long as you're trying to be creative in ways that grows more of God, especially in others, but yourself is included, that makes you a higher self. And in that particular process, although there are abundantly more mistakes you'll be making, the meaning in life dramatically increases, and success, eventually, at becoming more a co-creator with God does as well, even though you make more mistakes. And so while nobody relishes mistakes because we suffer some loss of consciousness by doing that, the benefit in the long run is a growth in consciousness of substantial proportions, much more than the small amounts of loss of consciousness that happens on a moment-to-moment basis while we're making some mistakes. The big picture is much better. The results are profound because we start becoming more like our soul, and the meaning in life starts multiplying vast amounts, and we become something so much greater than process. It's endless, too. There are no limitations. So you say, somebody says, well, you can't go there because you aren't great enough. You're as great as you make yourself into. You're creating yourself into a new being as you co-create with others using the most intelligent interactions and using all the knowledge that you have with the highest knowledge, the conceptual knowledge, or if you're capable, the heuristic knowledge from the Buddha plane as well. If you can do all that, you have great chances at doing tremendously wonderful things. Things of such proportions that it's even hard to believe for some people. You may change the world in a profound way and not really be trying to change the world in a profound way. But this may be the outcome of such great things when people start living their lives as souls, even though they make more mistakes because they're being creative so much more, and creation allows, makes more mistakes. You're not repeating tried and true stuff. You're going into the untrue stuff and finding some of it doesn't work. But the new things you do create eventually leads us to even greater and greater heights of being part of our, a co-creator with our creator. It's amazing, amazing stuff. All right, so knowledge, now we see knowledge as like capital. It's sort of like having a great resource, but it becomes an impediment when it's just held onto. And if it isn't used and co-served with others, it can be very devastating with a loss of meaning in life, or vice versa. So this has a real practical, I could call it practical application. This is not something that's so far out there that nobody can understand it. I know I'm stepping on some people's toes because there's people who probably are listening who don't do what I'm talking about, and they may experience some pretty sad nights and days too, because they may hold on to knowledge, or they may choose not to gain more knowledge, or whatever the story may be. Holding on is when I say that, I mean that they don't use it to intelligently coordinate themselves with others or to be intelligently more imaginative with others. They're basically into themselves. But when that happens, their life gets shriveled up, and they suffer the consequences of that, of course. Okay, so what's the best way to, we'll say, open yourself up to some of the things that I'm describing? Well, you look for people who need some things that you have a better understanding and knowledge about and you look for the opportunities to be of service to them. Service cannot be of benefit to you. It needs to be a benefit to them first. The only benefit you may derive will be eventually great joy and maybe bliss from them growing. And then eventually, there's a boomerang effect. Your consciousness will grow, and so will elements of your knowledge. And before long, you have acquired tremendous growth from a standpoint of wanting to wisely give to others. The wisdom involved in giving knowledge is to ensure that others are intelligently interacting in its use. I've talked about the lost races of the Atlanteans. Some people don't buy it. That's okay. But I'm going to use that as an example right now. Eventually, that group of sub-races of people had a big problem with knowledge, because the knowledge that they were given, literally, by some more advanced humans and superhumans, ended up being not applied in an intelligent way. So there were less intelligent interactions among and between and from and by each Atlantean, and that led to a reduction in their connection with the Creator and not being creative effectively with the knowledge they had. Yeah. And so it eventually led to darkness and evil. So it destroyed the lives and the races of humans at that time. That's because giving knowledge cannot be done if you're not going in a way that's good, unless you're completely taking responsibility that the knowledge you're giving will be helpful to others, to co-serve with still others, and to become more and more less using of energy. Remember, the energy efficiency model has very definite importance, and more, therefore, conscious in the way that it's applied. If that takes place, that's fine. But if you see the reverse, you stop giving the knowledge because you realize that you're being unwise and you're making a mistake. And if you're very sensitive to it, you see it long before it becomes a big problem. You may see a few small incidences and say, aha, I got it. Got to stop giving to this person or that person or this group because they aren't using the knowledge, or they're not using it in ways that help to increase intelligence. Meaning they are increasing the forces, decreasing light, decreasing the consciousness of themselves and others. And that's a bad outcome. Very bad one. Alright, so this whole thing seems to be actually a relatively clear process. Wisdom is knowing when, with whom, and how much, and why you give knowledge. You could say that wisdom also has to do with giving things in form other than knowledge, and that's true too. But I say that the knowledge part is more important than even things. Giving people wrong things just usually ends up with them destroying the thing itself and sometimes harming some other people with the form itself. But giving people knowledge that they are ill-equipped to give correctly to others and instead will use in a selfish way is far more destructive, far more dangerous, and can lead to a whole planet eventually becoming evil, which Earth never did and still is tenuous in that situation. Ah, so now we've got some, we'll say, definable ways that we can use what we have and how much to give or not give to others. Really important stuff. Really. What about people who have very limited knowledge? We know some of those folks. Everybody has that experience. The important thing isn't how much a person has, it's how much are they capable of having. It doesn't do much good if someone has a limited capacity to have a certain level of knowledge and try to say, well, I'll just give them a lot more. All that does is use up their senses in ways that are not productive and causes them to make even greater levels of mistakes. And the knowledge that they do have is usually used ineffectively and inefficiently, leading them to have a less meaningful life. So it's really important for us to be able to use our senses in understanding how we're going to relate to other people and why we're doing it. It's not a good thing, and I know some people who disagree with this, to say, well, the Bible tells me so, and this is the way God or my church says to do it, and to just, with everybody, tell them the same things in the same ways, because that's what is God, or the truth, or the word, or this or that. Those sorts of things, in my opinion, are foolish and may be involved with a great deal of selfishness and the need to try to manipulate and control people, rather than looking at it from the standpoint that we are here as creative beings. We have to create how we're going to relate with everybody we know. And no, we can't go by some standard or some doctrine of a particular religion or church. This is a difficulty. I know people prefer to have these rigid ways of doing things. It's so much simpler. It's also so much, in many cases, a bad idea. I know there's going to be some people who are thinking that they don't want to hear me because I'm going against the doctrines of the church or what they've been taught by their preachers or their rabbis or whatever. And so I'm just suggesting, you don't do what I say. You test it out. Check it out in your own life, because that also is another important element about the use of knowledge. Everything about knowledge should be tested. It should be examined. Just because somebody else says, well, I know it's right, so you don't have to worry about it. Yeah. Always take it upon yourself to challenge whatever you hear, from me or anybody, and to examine knowledge, particularly for truthful, if it's mental knowledge, or for emotively complete and loving, if it's astral, or we're called intelligent coordinates, so with little forces, if it's going to be in the therapeutical parts, that's where your gauges are. That's what you use to determine the validity. And so you get to these, we'll call it virtues, which is light and form, that tell us whether or not our knowledge is being used right and whether it is working for us and for others in co-creating and intelligent coordinated responses and intelligence in every way that we can interact with people depending upon the dimension that we exist with them on. Because those interactions do change depending upon where our consciousness is focused. That's where our life is in terms of the dimensional part of space. Be aware that some people are not dimensionally focused where their consciousness may seem to be. Some people, as an example, are in the physical world. Their consciousness is in their physical senses, but they focus more on their creative imagination and the brain that is involved in that than they do right here in the physical world and coordinating themselves with people here first. So in those circumstances, those folks, we would say, are more like they're living astrally. But they're not. I mean, in the astral world, and they don't even necessarily sense it directly. But nonetheless, a good deal of their attention to what knowledge they're looking for, which is coming from their creative imagination, is the more important thing. A lot of people like that. Some of them are very creative using that creative imagination, but they may do so at the cost of not balancing it with knowledge from the other parts of their existence. That can lead to a life with catastrophes in a number of ways, even though they're highly successful in being creative imaginatively in their life. And they use that to entertain people, they use it to help people understand a whole bunch of things dealing usually with love, and sometimes with other kinds of emotive responses and feelings that people have. Remember, we choose how we live. We create who we are. And if you choose to live your life that way, you're going to be different than a lot of other people. And it may be imbalanced and in some ways detrimental to becoming a soul. Because ultimately, the way I see the journey, ultimately we're here to become our souls no matter what else we think we're here to do. But becoming a soul is helping other souls to become souls. It's not just being a soul. Like with a little badge. I'm a soul, you know. Therefore, I'm done. I'm a soul. No, souls are co-creative together. They still are individuals, and they become more and more individual while they co-create together. So their individuality comes out in their creations that they share with others, but at the same time, they are helping others to do the same. I hope all that makes sense to you. All right, so let's talk about some of the things that are wrong with our world today and society in general. A lot of this so far has been applied to each of our listeners, right? But there are things that are happening in the world that just don't make sense anymore and that are real problems. Part of it is, in some ways, what some people call politics or governmental issues and things like that. Some of it has to do with a crisis in civilization. And I'm going to try to talk about, let me start with that because that may be kind of the biggest thing. And so we want to get through that first. Our world today is a world which is befuddling in terms of its treatment of knowledge. Instead of there being a rational approach to the holding of knowledge, explanation of knowledge, etc., it is the opposite. Because so many people are so selfish with the throat chakra, which is the communication of knowledge, in the physical world, particularly through this, but it's about all parts of knowledge, all the way to through the higher mental world, that you don't find that there is a cohesive place you can go to find the kind of knowledge that you're looking for about most things. Let's use the internet. Not everybody uses the internet, but let's use that as an example so that we can see it. Let's say you want to have knowledge about how to train your dog better, okay? And you want to recognize that the dog is a sentient being, and that you want it to be a more understanding itself, a more loving, you know, mental and astral way, as well as the physical behaviors that dogs sometimes don't necessarily do all the things we would like them to do. All that comes together. And so you're looking for an answer to how to best deal with that particular subject. Well, a lot of people would go dog training and type it in, you know, into one of the engines on the internet, and they get a whole bunch of stuff, you know, that would talk about various theories. In some cases, things people have experienced and what they learned in their experiences, what they tried, what worked and what didn't work, and what some experts, supposedly, who have some titles after their name, say, and a bunch of other stuff. Now, for a lot of people, that's a pretty common experience, right? But there's a problem with that dynamic, and let me explain what the problem is. In each case, each person who's putting that stuff up there is doing so usually tainted with not everyone, but maybe 99%. It's a pretty high number. tainted with their own, needs, desires, and selfishness. So they're not purely unselfish in what their motive is and also in what their interaction is in doing. So the knowledge that is acquired by going through the internet is predominantly controlled by the selfish spirit of the people who are getting it out there. Really, find someone who's really unselfish. And those people, oh, what a breath of fresh air. You finally find them, But you may have to look for hours before you get to that one person or group or whoever that's saying something that really just isn't about them, per se. And there's not these selfish aspects. So if we look at this as a microcosm of our society, there's a huge problem that, at least if you go back 1,000 years ago, there was such limited knowledge, and the people who had it would be a bit more, we'll say, discriminating, at least about who they gave it to, and were a little wiser about who they did it with. And some of them, but not the majority, were even doing so for truly altruistic and loving, truthful reasons. That's a rarity today. And it has to do with the proliferation of personality over soul in the way that we communicate in terms of our civilization, which has to do with the peculiarity of a thing called the third ray getting fixed and frozen. So it's not working in ways that are helpful for some people. And there is a dominance of trying to get something out of whatever people are doing. The internet is an example. Probably 90% of the things you're going to click on have ads, and people are trying to get you to buy something. They have some other weird process going on. And the 10% that don't have that have a need maybe to be known or to be appreciated in some way, which is not to give to others, but to in some way get something, whatever it is, even if it's just the esteem of others. All right, so these kinds of problems were less so than they are today, and they are like everywhere. We're infected with it. It's so great that it's hard to find something that's really clear and true. It really is. You can listen to an awful lot of radio. You're listening to some right now. And an awful lot of, read an awful lot of stuff before you get to anything that is in any way soul-like, meaning that it is truthful and unconditionally loving and wisely given and appropriately given for what is needed by the people who are looking for it. I mean, all of that is an amazing thing to try and find, and it's difficult. It's so difficult that some people don't try. They try for a short time and say, you know, this isn't getting me anywhere. I can't get anything out of this, because they can't get the knowledge that is going to be able, that they can use to create with others and be co-creative and to create more light in the world. It's a real tough experience. The more conscious you are, the more you can do it. But you still spend a lot of time and energy wasting in attempting to do that with virtually 99% of the stuff that's out there. And this is a big problem. Now, how do we get around that? The interesting process is to stop relying upon the old procedures of the last, say, 50 years or so after it has developed in a more severe way, and to be a clear conduit of knowledge so that it is presented in ways that others can, as much as possible, adopt a, we'll say, methodology that will test as easily as possible the validity, the ways of interacting with and disseminating and co-creating with it. That's the way, that's the key to the process. And if each person did more of that as a self-responsibility, if each person said, well, I'm not going to put up any garbage, I'm not going to say anything or do anything that doesn't fulfill these objectives of my soul and the souls of others, I will not do that. I will only do these things. We could improve this very quickly. I mean, like, within a year or two, things could change very quickly. It's going in the opposite direction, I know that. But the point is that we could move in this the correct direction. So as a society, we've got things messed up, and we can definitely improve it. Now, I'm going to tell you, the most present day, the most selfish, destructive stuff is things that are coming from the federal government in the United States, of almost any place in the world. How scary is that? I mean, we're supposed to be the beacon of light. We're supposed to be amazing. Well, you know, that's the big problem. And you see, when things as big as government, and especially the biggest of all governments, has, and the most powerful in some respects, has a agenda that is to provide falsehoods, deprive people rights, try to control people, use up unintelligently resources and destroy the resources of other people. When that's what's going on, it is of such significant destructive content that it alone could end up destroying this world. That's the thing that frightens me to some extent. You know, I talk about it as propaganda, but really it's just evil. It's just an evil, a darkness. It's really, really bad. And in the history of the United States, we're at the low ebb right now. It doesn't mean it hasn't been bad in the past. We've had some bad periods. But this is very bad. All right, so we've got to look at it from this standpoint. Everybody can do a little to make a difference. And believe it or not, it doesn't take a lot of people. It just takes the people who are doing it to do it in a really great way. And that can make as much a difference as just anything else you could imagine. We could make a huge difference collectively, even though we're a small in number, if each person does the best they can. Now, it's a big call for people, I know. A lot of people say, well, I've got so many other things. How am I going to make my rent, house payment, car payment? What am I going to do about the food costs? What am I going to do about education? This is more important because all those things won't matter if we don't correct the foundations of our problem. At the present time, most of what is happening that is really important is disinformation. It's lies. And lies over time erode a country. They make slaves out of people. And, it's the idea, as an example, and you may have heard some of this in recent days and weeks. Welfare, especially the welfare as in the United States presently is harping on, as done in some other countries, is extremely destructive to countries over time and the world in general. Why is it so much so? Because you're taking away, ultimately, the freedom of people to create. And remember, if you can't create with the knowledge you have, you lose your contact with your creator. So we started the show with, And so what you're really doing is you're, for most people on welfare, especially if they're there for a long time and under circumstances in which they're becoming more and more addicted to it, those people are going to eventually have meaningless lives based upon everything I said at the beginning of the show. You can check this out to see if it's true, of course. And they're going to further not only have meaningless lives, but they're going to become poorer and poorer, and the most critical thing is they're going to become slaves. They're going to not have the freedom that is necessary to create who and what they are, much less help others to do the same. The loss of their soul life is the greatest problem, but the other parts of their life will also be eroded and destroyed. I'm giving you this as an example now. It's not the only content of what's wrong, but it's the biggie right now today. All right, so everything seems to center around trying to get us, right, to be living more souls, and souls use their knowledge wisely, and they co-create with knowledge they have with others to create intelligent interactions, so everybody is starting to function more godlike together. But yet they're doing it in individually creative ways. So they're both individuals and they work together. Something that is hard for us to understand because there's so much contest about those two ideas as it's presently presented in some countries like the United States, where I'm, of course, talking from. So here we have some basis now to look at the next part of what we can do and the challenges that we have. And that's in how do we teach our younger people, especially our children, but anybody who's younger and has a lack in relative terms of knowledge in comparison to us, because we've lived longer and used our creations of the knowledge to a greater extent. What can we do to make improvements? And this is the single most important thing, so I'm going to say it first so that everybody says, oh, okay, I got that. And that is that education without the creation of something with the education on an ongoing basis is worthless and destructive. And almost all education today here in the United States that is public education is that. It's destructive. It's better that a person never even go to school than to go to a school in which they learn, usually through rote kinds of learning, knowledge that they don't use to create and co-create with their classmates and others new and wonderful things that are intelligent and help to reduce the forces in their lives and improves their relationship with their creator. Now, you don't have to say it that way. It doesn't have to be based upon God, but it is underneath. But some people would prefer that you don't. Okay, that's all right. But it has to be creative and co-creative, or it's better they never even learn anything. Think about everything I've said tonight, and it should immediately start like ringing bells. Like, if everything this guy said tonight, that makes a lot of sense, right? And if you think about the way we educate people today, at least here in this country, in public education now, and more so in higher education, whether it's public or otherwise, in any case, that's the problem. In professions that require certain levels of knowledge, it should be exactly the same issue. If a professional is not using their knowledge to be creative and co-creative with those that they are serving in their profession, and serving with and serving those who aren't in their profession, either way, if they aren't doing that, they're being destructive to themselves and to others. Whoa. So that means the more closed-minded the profession is and the lack of creativity that it it has, and the more it believes whatever it has is the only way to do whatever blank blank it is, and therefore they know all and blank blank blank, and they're not going to be co-creative with either their those that they are serving from their profession, the more destructive they are to the meaning in life, to the actual life of others. And again, it's all based upon a thing called principles in epistemology, or what I explained to you about earlier in the show tonight. It all goes back to the same concepts, but now we're applying them to practical matters in our society. Now, I know that this sounds like I'm a lunatic, right? Well, then a lot of professions are probably not doing very good. Well, that's true. It isn't true of all professionals within a profession. Some don't go along with what the profession may try to get people to believe or think. But the point is that I don't care if it's plumbing, I don't care if it's, you know, being an architect, or if it's being a dentist, too. They're all, in every circumstance, while you have respect for what others have come up with as being true, you also need to be co-creative with that knowledge and to test it yourself and to see if there are ways of surpassing it and making sure that those that you're co-serving with and those that you're helping to serve from the profession, whatever it is, are being themselves more intelligent in their interactions with you and from whatever you're doing for them. It's a big responsibility, and it's much more difficult to do than just to spend 20 minutes of your time doing something with someone and say, well, that's it. It'll be $500, please. Yeah, it's completely a different perspective on what it means to co-create with the knowledge that you have. It's like living your life in a whole new perspective. I hope you're understanding this, because this is really important, because it's one. I'm going into the areas that, because I won't have enough time tonight to talk about everything, but I'm going into the areas that are really significant in terms of what's wrong with what's happening and why things don't work the way people want them to work. Okay, so we got the education, and then we have the way it's applied in certain professional ways, and then we have another thing. The worst part about it is the restrictions of knowledge that's forced on others through rules and doctrines and control mechanisms that leads into all kinds of aspects, including especially the profession of businesses. So when we look at it from the standpoint of that, it's way over the top, way, way over the top. Every time a rule is applied coming from a level of knowledge that has not intelligently interacted with that who's being, the rule is being applied to, it's dark. And if it's done excessively and often, it's evil. Now look at what's happening today and see what you think about that. And the reason I can say that is based upon everything, again, that we've talked about, or I've talked about knowledge and how it really is a kind of foundation, a core foundation of how our whole society works. It is the form of thought that humans live most of their life by. Right? We're big into it. Animals, not so much so, and the plants, I don't think they really care much. But humans, it's a big deal. It's what civilization is about. It's the third part of God's mind. It's the third ray of structure in terms of the way energy focuses. And it's what civilization comes from, which is the third ray. So hopefully, if you understand that part, you can see how this is all fitting together. Knowledge is considered the backbone of the third ray. And hopefully I'm drawing it together now so that it makes more sense, because I've talked about this in very abstract terms before without giving concrete stuff, and people said, oh, I don't quite get what you mean. But it really means something. It's a big kind of meaning, the not a small kind of being. Okay, let's talk about some other elements of society that we don't sometimes think that knowledge is a big factor in. Interpersonal relationships. It can be romantic, what we sometimes refer to as marriage, but it might be even other kinds. Friendships on various levels. Business, some people call business, where people work together in a similar kind of way in an environment where usually money is involved and so is time and energy. When those things are taking place, the correct use of knowledge changes the nature of the perspective of the people involved. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you go to your job every day. All right. Oh, that's the thing. You think you're going here to earn money, right? But in reality, the richness of the job may have little to do with the amount of money that you earn, be it big, small, or whatever. It's about something that goes much, much deeper. People spend most of their personal life in vocation. You didn't know that. That's true. Most of their personal life is spent in vocation. And so to the personality, the way that a person works and the amount of money they make and certain other factors becomes a very important issue. Now, that's not bad. It's not a terrible thing. But to the personality, it's a selfish thing. If you want to use the knowledge that you have while you're in a working environment, you need to widen the perspective from that of the personality, that it's just a vocational issue so you can make so much money and maybe people like what you do so you get a few kudos and this and that. Maybe you get a title. But the most important part of it is that you help others to do their job better and do it in a way which is more intelligent in their interactions with not only you, but with everybody else. You can say, well, I'm not their supervisor. I'm not their manager. I'm not. You're something bigger than that. You're a cooperating, participating soul with their soul. See them that way and use your knowledge to help them from all the things I just said and much more, not because you are their supervisor or manager. But if you happen to be, that's okay. It doesn't matter. But do it because it is the most important thing you can do while you're working. Most people don't do that. Well, I don't like to get my personal life involved with my work life. I'll keep them separate. Really? That perspective will only get you one thing, a less meaningful life, and a life in which you're less a soul. Because we spend a lot of our time doing that. Work and vocation, big time, and that's a huge amount of time people spend doing. And if they're going to hold, oh, I'm not going to let that knowledge out, because if I do, who knows what they'll think of me. No, if I talk about angels' wisdom, maybe I'll get fired. Or maybe they'll just think I'm goofy. Maybe they'll think I am a non-believer in God. Or maybe they'll think I am a believer in God. Maybe whatever. Everybody is so concerned about what other people think of them. And especially in the cases of where they work. Is that not strange? Because that's where they spend, in comparison to virtually anything else, the majority of their time. Wow. They may spend more time at work than they do with, if they have a family, with their specific family. Even though they might be home, they're not interacting with their family most of the time. Okay, Now, family is another thing. We're going to get to it. But the issue here is that people need to be changing their perspective, because you've got to get over your fear of loss of your job or anything else. And instead, you need to be unafraid to be yourself. And we've got a major, major problem with that in almost every part of life, not just here in this country where I'm at, but everywhere. It's almost like this universally, isn't it? I mean, it isn't that different in a lot of other places. Some places are, I'm sure, but most places are similar. Okay, let's talk about the family, because we're, again, time. I don't want to get too far into one thing. In terms of people's family life, the issue should be, and it's kind of the reverse of the job, so I think it's good to put these two together and juxtapose them so you can see. People tend to believe that they should all think together the same, children, adults, husband, wife, extended family, brothers, cousins, whoever, sisters, that. And from that standpoint, there's a threat to the personal interest of people when there is a significant difference in the way that people especially create or co-create with the knowledge that they have. So what happens is the following, which is very bad, dangerous for any kind of familiar relationship. They exclude the knowledge that they have in any way that is in contradiction to that of, or in some way an infraction of, what others think in terms of knowledge in their familiar settings. So they isolate themselves that way. Instead of being more intelligent in their interactions, they just don't have very many interactions. Okay? And there's no problem. So we don't think the same. We don't have the same knowledge. We don't buy the same kinds of knowledge. And that's going to solve everything. We just have less interactions and everybody's fine. Well, that is the road to destruction in relationships. It ultimately means that you don't co-create with your family. And that is a real bad problem, because the idea of family is to learn to be a soul on a mini scale. And the family is like the work-it-out place. That's what it's supposed to be in human terms. And it becomes the work-it-not-out place, which is a very negative and, we'll say, kind of meaningless way to exist. But that's what happens. And, of course, the family life becomes less and less meaningful in those circumstances. We end up with divorces, we end up with delinquency in children, we end up with alienation among everybody that's in the family and even extended families and then sometimes neighbors. And I mean, it gets into nutso stuff, right? Partly because a differentiation in the way people treat their knowledge and what they think is true or not true leads to threat on a personal level to people, instead of being a creative means of working together to find the truth in all circumstances, even if it contradicts one's level in comparison to someone else in the family, be it immediate family or nuclear family or the extended family. So you have this as something to challenge, and it should be treated as a challenge to break through it. Freedom of thought is extremely important, but most importantly is the encouragement for people to be able to and to communicate together, even those things, and especially those things, that there is either lack of knowledge that's complete on each side, or a difference, a significant difference in the understanding of the knowledge that is there. So that you find new ways to intelligently coordinate, to intelligently imagine, to intelligently thinking concepts that either are or are not true. So you find truth much more while you find where you're making mistakes in truth much more as well. Can be painful. You might not look in the same eyes to yourself or others in your family the same way with the level of esteem you would like to have because, well, I'm never wrong. But you need to be wrong. Being wrong is helpful because it's a way of growing ourselves. But when we grow that way, you grow together rather than apart. If you don't do that, if you go down the road, which is more traditional, maybe in a lot of cases, you grow apart. Literally, grow apart, and life becomes less meaningful for each person in the family. Now, this is somewhat true of friends as well. And when we get to the question of friends, it is interesting that sometimes, in some circumstances, some friends tolerate more differences than families do in terms of how they deal with the question of knowledge and knowledge being used to increase intelligent activity. And some friends get that right. They say, well, differences are okay. We can live with the differences because we help each other to grow and find out more about everything that we think we know. That's a good way of doing it. It's an excellent way of doing it. Now, the more you have of strong, and we'll say, deep understandings of things, the more you may threaten some people that normally you could be friends with, but because your quote-unquote concepts are so well understood, others may be threatened by that because they can't understand it at the level you're at, so they don't know whether it is true or not, but it's too much for them. That may drive away certain people. That is not necessarily a terrible thing because you just need to get people who are at the same level of ability. Remember we talked earlier in the show about level of ability. Trying to be friends with people of much lesser ability to be able to think and create knowledge and then co-create it with others is not a bad thing. You can still help those that don't have it if they want. But if they don't or are threatened by it, it doesn't seem to help to force people to try to accept what I know. Better to let them be whatever they want to be and with whomever they want to be with. That's the area where exclusion is not necessarily a damaging part. It would be damaging in a family because you're committed to being together in a family. But it's not true among people that you meet that you could or could not be choosing to be friends with. Choose friends that have the same level of ability to think and then have the same level of commitment to learn, understand, and then to co-create in terms of intelligent responses and intelligent interactions. Then you're on the right track. What happens if you don't find those kinds of people? Well, probably you need to be more creative in the way that you are presenting yourself and looking. Maybe you can find a way of doing that even on the internet where people aren't doing it right. Instead, they use stereotypical things that don't get to the depth of who they really are, so they don't meet the right people, and that is a problem. So maybe some people can reconsider how to use that instrument or the internet or some other means. And it's also how you communicate with people. Being creative is really a moment-to-moment basis. It isn't a matter of taking a class or learning something new so you can create something. It's just the opposite. It's that you have so much to be creative from your past levels of being a being of consciousness and being able to put together new parts of knowledge in new ways, or old parts of knowledge, I should say, in new ways, that allows there to be something new created. And that's what the purpose of creation is. So we should look at it from the opportunity that it happens every minute of our life. And we don't have to go take a course in something to be creative. It's not true. I mean, I'm not saying you can't take courses or do anything new. Of course you can do anything you want. But I think that that's a misnomer. So it helps us to look at it as our life is the tapestry that we're going to be making ourselves from everything that we are already. We don't have to learn anything new. We need to use what we already are to create something new, especially co-creatively with new people, with the people we already know, and with any new people we meet. This is the great opportunity. This is what's so wonderful about being human, and not being some animal, or let's say not being even a relatively young person. Young people have a very solipsist kind of viewpoint, because from their standpoint, they have minimal amounts of understandings about most of the knowledge they have. They are trying to basically become, we'll say, more knowledgeable. But for adults, they have a great deal of knowledge all the time that they aren't using. And they could be using it a great deal more in an interactive way with other people around them if they're willing to do it. It's a matter of that willingness. And so many people are afraid, or they're just tired or lazy or think it's worthless. But there's a tremendous value in it. The value is it grows us. Because remember, without being creative with the knowledge we have, what happens? Our life becomes meaningless over time. Our life becomes more meaningful when we choose to be creative. And when we do so each moment virtually, that's like a huge change. So many people don't do this, that it's unbelievable, really. And it's become the hallmark of what a lot of people think of as an easy life. Oh, I don't agree with anything. I like my life simple and easy. And that way I don't get into any trouble with anybody or anything. Then people like that end up getting depressed. And they wonder why their life is meaningless eventually. And, of course, they created it that way by not creating. All right, so hopefully that makes some sense at this point. Now, I understand we lost a couple of minutes in tonight's show. It's not that terrible of a situation. We'll, you know, I still cover everything that we need to cover. So you can see that there's a real practical issue here. If someone, any of you out there, are thinking, gee, my life isn't really as meaningful as I'd like it to be, well, if you want your life to be more meaningful, be more creative in it. Use the knowledge that you have. Combine it with everything that you can get from anybody else and interact with them. Co-create and be creative in every way possible. Look at everything you do as an opportunity to, in some way, be more creative. Now, you could ask me, well, do you do that? And I would say, with some humility, hopefully, most of the time I do. But the point is that isn't something that I necessarily think about at this point on a moment-to-moment basis, because I've created myself into being that way. So eventually you reach a point where you don't have to think about it all the time and do some self-analysis. Eventually, it becomes who you are, because we, by nature, are that way as souls. So the more you become your soul, eventually you don't have to just keep thinking about it and say, well, am I really doing it or not? Because it's just the way you are. But in the beginning, yes, there probably is maybe even years of time where people need to think about this. They need to be evaluating it on a moment-to-moment basis, because we're in the opposite role. We're not, it isn't natural. It's the natural thing is to not be creative. And it's very, very Well, it's like disappointing to me that so many people are like that because they aren't being their souls and they are suffering from a meaningless or more meaningless existence than meaningful. They're making it that way and they don't even realize that's what they're doing. And it's a big deal. That we are so much in control of it is a good thing, but if you're doing it in a way that's destructive to the meaning in your life and possibly and probably to those others that you know, that's a bad thing. Okay, what about the challenge of being creative in a system that is trying to destroy creativity and freedom and all the other things? Now, this is true here in the United States to some extent, but it's even more true in some countries that are run by dictators of a more, we'll call it, formidable nature, and in places where there's violence and destruction going on. If that's the case, sometimes the best thing that you can do is to be so focused on being a beacon of light, even if it may mean that your life eventually may end earlier than expected. The beacon of light helps other people to get the courage to face their fears, because it's fear that allows people to be enslaved and subjected to such extreme circumstances. If everybody in any environment was, or most people were at least unafraid of death especially, but unafraid of many things that they think of, those people would then be much more creative. So fear is the enemy of the soul, and it's the enemy of being creative in life, and it's the enemy of using our knowledge. Remember, we have to use it creatively, or it becomes a millstone around us. It forces us to stop growing and to have retained energy as knowledge that destroys our senses and causes us to become less and less meaningful in our existence. There's the answer for those people in that situation. You've got to be brave. And I know that's a tough one. And it may mean facing and actually, in some cases, dying from a lifetime in which, you know, you'd like to live longer, be more capable of doing something here. But sometimes you've got to just literally do what is the most enlightened thing to do, which may be facing some terrible circumstances. This is a tough world we chose to live to incarnate in. And the use of knowledge has become the hallmark of our problem. Both good or bad, it has been the hallmark of the way things have gone in here on Earth. Earth is a third-ray planet. What that means is that knowledge becomes a prominent issue in its development. There's some planets where it's not so much that way. But here it's a biggie. And therefore we suffer the consequences when we gain knowledge and it isn't used co-creatively to increase intelligent interactions, or we don't gain knowledge and we choose to become literally ignorant. In either case, it leads to a very negative experience on Earth. This Earth's prominent issue is a third-ray success, which includes the proper expression, development, sharing, co-creation of knowledge to create us into souls. There are other avenues to be a soul, by the way. You don't have to stick with the third-ray method, because there are many people who don't. But the important thing to realize is even if you don't, you still have to live in a world that is dominated by it. And so you need to understand what you're dealing with, even if your methodologies may be somewhat in a direction, at least a bit, if not a lot, away from just the question of knowledge. Some people's lives don't revolve that much as compared to others in the knowledge domain. That's okay. So don't think of tonight's show being all about knowledge means that that's the only thing that's important. It's not. There are many other ways of expression of self. But humans, by nature, are into a big way of, we'll say, using knowledge, because we're the first form of life that has knowledge to be useful in all the dimensions that we live within. And to do so, we'll say, in a way which is equally distributed in some circumstances, depending away upon who you are and who you create yourself into. But again, the third-rate issue on Earth is really torturous. It's just hard to get away from it, even if you're doing some other things that aren't so knowledge-based. It still tremendously influences us. And again, we wouldn't be here if we didn't see what we're doing here as important as a soul. So eventually you'll discover that there is a connection to what's important here on Earth and why you're here. That happens actually during the advanced initiations, if you can imagine. That's really almost the time when you're leaving the human kingdom. It's when people really understand why they're here on Earth rather than some other planet. So it's even to the soul itself somewhat a mystery, but it's more so to the humans that are incarnated through the soul. And even to the soul, it understands it at a certain level, but not the same level as its alter ego, the solar angel, which has a better understanding of the process. But that's not unusual in spiritual development. The knowledge that we have is always less than the areas that we need to grow into. So no matter what people say, no matter what they claim they have in knowledge, it's not good enough, not great enough for them to gain enough understanding to say that they have full understanding of whatever it is that they're doing. Part of that has to do with consciousness, because consciousness processes knowledge to recombine it. It also has to do, though, with our ability to sense and be able to get accurate knowledge that doesn't have to constantly be refined and filtered, to be taking it out of the realm of being able to be used until we can make it so that we know that it is both truthful and loving and cooperative, as well as possibly serving even into beyond the human kingdom. These are the areas that we have the most amount of trouble in, because human beings have less than perfect senses, less than perfect abilities to deal with gaining knowledge and growing consciousness. We are struggling all the time. So no matter how much we strive to be spiritual, we fall short on those other sides, and that causes us to, unfortunately, not be able to fully have either knowledge or understanding, which is consciousness, enough to do the spiritual path we're actually on. So we're always trying to catch up and try to figure out how come this is happening now. And it's usually a question that can't be fully answered at the time. Of course, later on, we kind of figure it out. Okay, we're running out of time. And I hope that this has really made a difference tonight, because one of the areas that I think most people don't have a good understanding about is knowledge. So I think I've covered this subject pretty well tonight and given a lot of explanation of how it fits into our life and what kinds of things we can do to make our life a better life and make our existence here more soul-like. And hopefully all of you will be able to take what I said tonight, and you can re-listen to the show and use it in an effective way, so that this will make you and those that you interrelate with more soul-like as you interact higher and higher levels. But we are definitely out of time. And until next week, this has been Niles McFarlane for Why Life Is.